Accession number 9227, Reel 1.
Mr. Brown, Reel 1. Could you explain when you went to Hong Kong and why, and what the journey out was like?
I was a civil servant in the Financial Advisors and Army Audit Office, which was an organization which the Army had. The Army in those days was comprised of commands, with general officers commanding, and each general officer commanding had a financial advisor. The role of he and his staff was to give financial advice to the general on the basis that if the general wanted to spend money on anything, he had authority up to certain limits. If he consulted his financial advisor, then he had greater powers. And the financial advisor regarded himself as an outpost of the War Office, authorized to speak on behalf of the War Office, but he was not a member of the staff of the GOC. He was independent. And in addition to these financial powers or advice, the staff were responsible for audit of all the Army accounts, stores, supplies, cash, and so on. And I was, in 36, I joined that staff in Aldershot as a young executive officer, age 18, and I volunteered to go abroad, which is one of my reasons why I selected War Office as an office to join the civil service. So in 1939, I was told I couldn't go before I was 21. But as soon as I was 21, in November 38, I was told I was going to Hong Kong. This was marvelous because it was the other side of the world, a place which I wanted to be as far as I could be. My posting was for August 1938. And then war was imminent in August 38, and so my posting was cancelled. I had bought, because I wasn't given a clothing allowance, I'd bought my own tropical clothing, and for that I had to borrow money from my father because my pay was only £144 a year and living in digs. But in September, after war had broken out, I was told that my posting was standing and I was going to go. So in September 1939, the end of September, I received instructions to label my baggage Q, no other thing at all, Q3, I beg your pardon, Q3, no other thing at all, and to report to Waterloo Station, where I would receive further instructions. I arrived at Waterloo Station to find that there were a lot of other people around with Q3 on their baggage, and a lot of them seemed to be connected with India in some ways, because all their other baggage was connected with India. And I was told to get on a train, which would take me to Southampton. I arrived at Southampton. Oh, the porter said to me, "Oh, you're going to India, sir." I said, "Well, I didn't know that, but still, it was everybody who seemed to have, you know, Indian labels in their baggage." I arrived, and before I left, I was told that I would have to arrange my own insurance. The War Office in those days weren't very kind to staff. I had inquired in London about insuring my baggage and was told that war risks were something like 25%, and they really weren't interested. So I thought, well, I can't afford that, so I forget it. I arrive at Southampton, and I'm taken to the biggest ship I've ever seen, great grey ship, and I see painted out the name Empress Australia. She had just come off the run from Canada, where she'd taken the King and Queen to Canada that year. And I found myself on board in an A-class cabin on the top deck because I was connected with the War Office, and I was sharing a first-class cabin with another member of our staff who I hadn't met before. I inquired about insurance at the quayside, and I was told, well, it was 16%. We were only allowed to take £16 in money out, which I had, and I thought, well, no, I forget insurance. We set off in a four-ship convoy. Empress Australia, the Alcantara, the Athlone Castle, and the Franconia. And we had a two-destroyer escort. And we proceeded somewhere across into the Atlantic. We had a scare one day about, and the destroyers dropped depth charges. And we eventually got to Gibraltar, not allowed ashore. And there one of the ships left us. The Aspen Castle left us to go down to South Africa. We carried on to the Mediterranean with one destroyer only this time. And on a broad, perfect sunlight day, not a ripple on the sea hardly, we were zigzagging, as we did in those days, a seaplane, a small seaplane, came over. And I knew, on deck looking, and we were almost in line abreast. The Franconia and the Alcantara, one zigged and the other zagged. And these two great ships collided. They played bumps a daisy. They hit the bow, they went astern, and they came apart in the stern. Ships, lifeboats were all out at action stations, so they were all crushed. The bow of the Franconia was badly damaged, and the Athlone Castle was, all those upper works were bashed in. The destroyer went mad, running round and round around us. All I could assume was that somebody had looked up at the seaplane and had mistaken an order, and this was it. So we eventually limped in to a small convoy with a destroyer going around us into Malta. There we left the Franconia and the Alcantara, and the Empress Australia carried on bringing some of the people from those boats on, and we went to Portside. Portside was the first impression I'd ever had of the Far East and of abroad, and it was fascinating. We were allowed ashore there; it was the first time. And again, I inquired about insurance, and this time it was 6%, but I had bought myself a camera, and I hadn't got enough money to spare. It was a coal-burning ship in those days, and we coaled in Suez. And if anybody's never been on a coal-burning boat, they really don't understand what it's like. We then went through the Red Sea, when the conditions were deplorable, because you had no air conditioning in those days. We had a following breeze, and various times the ship would turn round and steam backwards to blow air through. We had several deaths from heat stroke aboard.
What month was that, which you were going through the Red Sea?
October. Yes. The bathing arrangements were you could have hot and cold salt water shower, hot and cold salt water baths, and you had a small tub of fresh water which you could sluice yourself down after having a salt shower. We eventually arrived at Bombay, and we were allowed ashore at Bombay, and again, this was most impressive to see, this fantastic city. And I went ashore, and I went to shipping agents, Cox and Kings, and I inquired about insurance, and they said £1. So I said, right, I'll have £1 per 100. So I said, I'll have a pound's worth. And they said, well, we'd like to fill out this form, name a ship. I said, I'm sorry, I can't give it to you. So they said, oh, you're on that big ship that came in this morning. And I said, oh, yes, that's the one. So that's all right, then we'll cover you. I then go back to the ship and find that there's a big notice up saying the ship is no longer going to the Far East. In fact, it went down to Australia. And all personnel ashore. And I was put up in the Taj Mahal Hotel, which really was the luxury I've never seen in my life. I had a bearer who in my room who insisted on almost undressing me and dressing me. And when we went down to eat, there were about four bearers all around the table, doing anything you wanted. I then didn't know quite what was going to happen, but I then received, I was to go overland to Calcutta by train with another member of our staff. And I went to Cox and Kings and said, look, I'm very sorry, I'm no longer on that boat, I said, and I don't know how I'm going to get to Hong Kong, but they said, don't worry, when you get on whatever ship you're on, write for the next port and let us know, and we will, you're covered, don't worry. So we go across on this train. Fortunately, I had met on the ship going out two Indian civil servants, inspector of factories in Bengal province was one. And they knew the ropes. You had to, before you got on the train, rent a sleeping bag with a mattress for the train, because it was 36 hours' journey. And they said, wear Otis clothes, because it's going to be a filthy journey. And it was. We had a compartment for four, two lower bunks and two upper bunks. The train stopped for meals, and you got out and you went up to a dining room car. And early in the morning, an Indian would come along to your carriage with chota hazri, a little breakfast, before you had your breakfast. And it was an eye-opener to travel across India this way. We had to, the next morning, take on a block of ice, which was put in the floor of the cabin with a fan above it as a means of cooling. That melted, slopped on the floor, and made a kind of thick gravy of the dust on it. It really was a filthy journey. Anyway, it was very interesting. We arrive at Calcutta, and there we're put up in the Great Eastern Hotel. I think Calcutta is the most crowded, poor city I had ever seen. I was appalled at the poverty that was there. I was there about a week, and then I was put on a boat called the Sardana, a British India cargo passenger. Had about a dozen first-class a dozen passengers, and carried a lot of people we call deck passengers. Now, amongst these were a lot of Rajputs. They were going out to Singapore, and we went down through the to the mouth of the Ganges, and then out. And the first stop was Rangoon. And in Rangoon, we were there for a week, loading and unloading cargo. And again, a most fascinating place. The Irrawaddy running about 8 or 9 knots. The Shwedagon Pagoda. And Rangoon was a beautiful city. Absolutely lovely. Orderly, clean, and so on. From Rangoon, we went up to Penang. And at Penang, I went ashore with a cabin mate of mine who was a cable and wireless sensor. He was one of 10 that had come out from England on the same boat as I was on, who were ex-cable and wireless employees who were sent out as sensors of cable information going through the Far East. In other words, they were able to get messages, interpret them, or read them, and decide what to do about them. And I was sharing a cabin with one of them. We had two bunks, one above the other. He had the bottom bunk, I had the top one. His baggage went under his bunk, mine stood on end. At Penang, we went ashore. He said, come ashore for a day and see the sights. And I remember before I went off, going to wash my hands and found no water. The ship was taking on water, so they just shut the water off. Thought no more about it. We had a day touring around Penang, came back on board, and I found the gangway outside the cabin strewn with my belongings. The water had come on, a little stopper in the basin had rolled down. It had overflowed and filled up the whole of the cabin floor and covered the cabin to a depth of the sill, which is about 9 to 10 inches. And, of course, my bags being on end, water got in and books and that. So between Penang and Singapore, I wrote out an insurance claim for damage done to clothing by water, which the skipper signed, and I arrived in Singapore. In Singapore, we had a staff, the financial advice staff, and a young executive officer there was a friend of mine I'd had in Singapore, and so he took me around. And on the 13th of November, we left Singapore on a perfect morning, absolutely lovely, flat calm. And I was standing on the port side watching the island go by when suddenly there was an enormous great bang. The ship jumped up in the air and water poured over me from the side. And one didn't really know what had happened. I then heard some screaming, so I thought, oh dear, we've been hit by something. And we were told to then you had to get your tope. So I went down to the cabin to get my tope and as I went out, the only thing I could see on the table was a little alarm clock I'd had for my 21st birthday and my camera. I grabbed those in shorts and T-shirt and sandals. I went up. But this time the ship was heeling very, very badly. Went to my boat station and saw an absolute chaos because we had about 800 deck passengers on board, including some 50 deportees. These were Chinese being deported from Singapore to Hong Kong, and they were under lock and key down below. The deck passengers had rushed the boats even before they left. The crew of the Sardana weren't very skilled, and some boats, when they went down the falls, they fell vertically and threw everybody out into the water. Other boats landed in the water. People in the water tried to climb in and turn them over. It was absolute shambles. But the boat I was supposed to be in was the chief engineer's boat. And that, for some reason, was late going down. And so we were all standing waiting to go in. There were a lot of women, too, from Singapore going to Hong Kong on leave. And eventually, this chief engineer said, for God's sake, get down into that boat. But this time, the time the women had been put on, the boat was down in the water, and it seemed to be about a mile below. And there was a ladder going down the side, so I was told to get on the ladder and go down. And halfway down, I found the ladder going back up again. And by this time, my cork life jacket was under my neck, strangling me. My helmet was being pushed down on my head by people trying to get down from the top. And below me was a lifeboat already full of people, about 15 feet below. But then somebody let the ladder go, and so we got in. We then pushed off from the side, and there was a Lieutenant Colonel Dawson of the Royal Tank Corps who took control. And the crew were nowhere to be found, nothing we could find until we realized the oars were all underneath us. So there's a bit of order sorted out. There were people swimming, there were empty lifeboats. And eventually we realized we were in the middle of a minefield. And so Dawson set somebody up in the bows to keep watch. And we slowly made our way out. Now, there was a very fine character, Major Leslie of the Seaforth Highlanders. And he was a very fine figure man, great big moustache. And he'd been on the next boat along. But a woman had, this is the kind of thing that happened in these things, had cleaned my hat box. And Leslie said, well, madam, I'll get it for you. Rushed down to her cabin, came back with the hat box, and the other thing he wanted was his wife's wedding photograph. His boat was turned over, and we saw Leslie swimming in the water with a pipe in his mouth, calling out to us, saying, Dawson, Dawson! Pick me up. And Dawson said, I'm sorry, old boy, I can't, we're full, but there's an empty boat there, go to that. So Leslie did swim to this boat, and then a lot of people in our boat hadn't got hats. This is honestly true. And so the woman's hat box was opened, and her hats were distributed around for people who didn't have them. This was, you know, those days when sunstroke was regarded as something that was to be feared. We eventually got outside the minefield because the rescue boats weren't allowed to come in, couldn't come in. And then we were taken ashore, and I landed ashore in just what I stood in. They reckon about 17 people lost their lives, and they're not really sure because some could have been the deportees who took the opportunity to escape. The Indian guard on the deportees just went, left them locked up. But one of the British police officers travelling went down, shot the lock away and let them out. So it's quite possible there weren't quite as many. But it really was a shambles. The boat went down in 15 minutes. It was very quick. But
what line did this boat belong to?
British India.
What was the crew?
The crew was Indian, except for white officers. That was quite normal in those days, particularly the British India Company. I had 3 days in Singapore. The staff we had there, of course, provided me with money and also provided some clothes for me immediately. And 3 days later, I was told I was to go on to Hong Kong on a small... at the same time, I wrote off two Cox and Kings, saying, Dear sirs, with reference to my claim for damaged clothing, I now regret I've lost the lot. And... then we left Singapore on this little boat called Hosang. Now, I find myself the only other passenger except for Major Leslie of the Seaforth Highlanders. And he said to me, Brown, he said, come on, we're going to find where our lifeboat station is, and also we must go and see the captain to find out where the minefield is. Because it became apparent that the skipper of the Sardana did not know that there was a minefield there. The chief officer who was responsible for amending the charts had put the minefield in the wrong place. And we'd gone slap bang through one of our own minefields. Leslie went to see the captain, and we both went in. He knocked on the door and he went in and said, excuse me, captain, do you know where the minefields are? And the captain went almost beetroot red and said, you know, spluttered. And he said, well, we're just off the Sardana. And he then laughed and said, don't worry, I know exactly where they are. So we completed the last leg on this boat called the Ho Sang Belong to Jardy Matheson. Got to Hong Kong, I think somewhere in about November, the beginning, and day prior to a typhoon, which was almost unknown in November. And so my first day in Hong Kong was spent locked up in a boarding house, in a small hotel, with shutters up, with the wind screaming outside and rain. But at least I got there. And Cox and Kings, the agents, paid me £100, which was enough to re-equip myself in those days. It really did. I not only re-equipped myself, but I also, with that, spent £35 and bought myself a small yacht, which was my pastime.
How long had this journey out taken you together?
I had left at the end of September, and I arrived somewhere about the November the 20th, I should think. Yes.
What were your first impressions of Hong Kong when you got out of your boarding house?
It was the life, teeming with people, teeming with people. So different to anything one had ever seen or thought about. Food shops, stalls, the markets, the bustle. It was just life teeming, something one had never seen. And I think it was so strange to me going over on the Star Ferry across to the mainland were Chinese talking to each other in English. Because, as you know, there are so many languages or dialects in China that they can't converse orally, but so their common language is English. And it looks so strange to see these Chinese dressed in their costumes, which were traditional at that time, just talking to each other in English. I found that one could, it was a good life. One didn't need money, not in one's pocket. You could go to any hotel, any shop, and buy something and sign what they call a chit. Just sign your name and where you were, and that was quite good enough. Nobody ever queried or asked anything more. And at the end of the month, these chits would be presented to you, and you would be expected to pay, which was quite the thing. And, of course, the sea was my hobby, and the yacht club there was just beginning to move from the mainland across to a small island called Kellet Island, and the sailing was superb. It really was marvellous, because you had a marvellous harbour for racing. You had glorious little islands just outside where you could go for weekends or for long. So that for me, Hong Kong was the sea and the sea people, the people on the junks, the people on the sampans. I kept my boat in a typhoon anchorage near Happy Valley, and that was packed with life. Whole family would be living on one small sampan, chickens and all. And that was their home. I decided I would learn some Cantonese because you, unless you can communicate, you're isolated from the people. So I had an old Chinese teacher who used to come to me once a week and teach me the rudiments of Cantonese. And he was really the old school. He used to come, take off his outer gown, almost in his underclothes, and then sit fanning himself. Half the time he'd fall asleep while I was with him. But at least I got a feel of the old China. And he'd do his exercises, which they loved doing. So I learned some Cantonese. And with that, it made a much bigger life for one in Hong Kong. Also, there was a group of young people from the yacht club. We had young cadets from the government, young cadets in the police force. And at times of like Christmas or New Year, then the police would arrange for a village to have a pig shoot or a deer shoot. And we'd sail up in our boat, and the cruisers would go up, and we'd get seats in the cruisers or go up in our own boats. And then the village would bring out the beaters, and they would be shooting. The police used to fly the rifles for us, and the interesting thing to me was I don't like shooting, but was going to the Chinese villages, and in the evenings discussing or hearing discussions with them about the way of life in their villages itself, and then the walking over the hills of the new territories, which were beautiful, particularly the outer ones where you could go in a boat, but there was you normally wouldn't go to, like Tai Po and places like that. So Hong Kong to me was really the sea.
Sounds idyllic.
It was, yes, yes.
It doesn't sound as though you were much aware of what was going on in Europe.
One was, yes. There was a thing called a bomber fund. Now, I was living in a boarding house. I hadn't got much money because we weren't paid very much. And there were a number of us who really couldn't afford to go out gadding in nightclubs or hotels, places like that. And so we were on our own. And we formed Mahjong Club for the Bomber Fund. And this was a society we had of our own. Do you know Mahjong? Well, if you've got a limit hand, then you were entitled to wear the club tie, which was a special tie we had made with the Green Dragon. But any money was put into the Bomber Fund. We were very aware. We had the news. We were very conscious of what was going on in Britain. Also, too, we were well aware because the whole of the garrison was slowly being milked because the effort was in Britain. And from my job, I knew that money was wanted for building defences on what was called the Gin Drinkers Line, but there was none available. I mean, all the resources that could be, men and money, was clearly devoted to UK in that period of 39, 40 and 41. No, we were very, very aware of what was going on. Also, too, from sailing, I knew very well where the Japanese were, because they were right up to the borders. And when we sailed up Mers Bay, you could almost see the Japanese outposts up on the shore around the bay. So we knew the Japanese were there. But the amazing thing was that despite the Japanese being there, the traffic that was going from Hong Kong through the Japanese lines to the nationalist forces in Chongqing, you could see a stream of sampans and junks leaving places like Tai Po and the islands, going up to Mers Bay, where the Japanese were. And there they would be offloaded, and petrol was being taken up in 4-gallon cans, all manner of things. And they were going to the Japanese line. Somebody was paying the Japanese to let them go through.
Did you ever go to the mainland when it was under Japanese occupation?
No, no. No, there was no way of doing it. I mean, the border was closed virtually, and one could only just remain inside and watch.
Now, you mentioned the Gin Drinkers Line.
Yes.
Now, where was that drawn, and what was it supposed to be?
There is a range of hills on the New Territories which run virtually from east to west, and that was called the Gin Drinkers Line. That was really a natural defence, which required a certain amount of fortifications and emplacements and places like that to make it a first-class line of defence. In fact, very little was able to be done to it. It was started, but it was never completed because of the financial restrictions.
What sort of force was intended to be used to occupy this line?
In Hong Kong, there were two battalions, two British battalions. At that time, there were the Royal Scots and the Middlesex Regiment, two Indian battalions, and we had the Rajputs, the 5th, 7th Rajputs, and the 2nd, 14th Punjabis, and the Hong Kong Volunteers, with a mobile artillery unit of the it was a Hong Kong